This is a production of Cornell University.
Sorry, folks, I don't have my gavel today, so it's not allowed me. Moving into roll call. Al, Clovis.
Yeah.
Anna.
Yeah.
Casey. Casey's not here yet. Rena. Elena. Also not here. Elizabeth.
Here.
Ian.
Yeah.
Jesse.
Here.
Jonathan.
Here.
Julia. Not here.
She should be here.
He's
leaving early.
Here, I'm here.
Yeah.
Amisha. Here.
Margaret.
Here.
Okay. Margaret M.
Wait,
what's
Margaret?
I said Margaret. Margaret. Margaret M. Sarah. Oh, not here. Excuse. Tasha. Also not here. Todd.
Here.
And Yanni.
Rachel. Here.
Up in the back. How many people does that give us?
Six people.
Oh, that's totally fine. That's well. So we have quorum. Now we're moving into approval of the minutes. So.
Oh, wait. Can I change the agenda?
Yeah. What would you like to change?
Okay, I have a couple. One, can we add academic calendar to breakout sessions? Can we move reports of officer and committee updates right after breakout session?
Okay.
And can we move Sarah Apple to right before open forum?
All right, so I'll repeat that. Remove or add, what did you say?
Add academic calendar.
Add academic calendar to
breakout
session. Move reports of the officers and committee updates before new business, and move Sarah Apple's presentation to just before open forum. Is there any dissent to that motion? Seeing none, the motion passes. We'll make those changes. Jesse, yeah.
Motion to add resolution 7 to the agenda under new business.
Motion to add resolution 7 to the agenda under new business. Is there any dissent? All right. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, resolution 7 is added to new business. Okay. So now back to approval of the minutes. Does anyone want to make any changes to the minutes?
Second.
Is there any dissent to approving the minutes? Seeing none, the minutes are approved. Okay, and now we move into our first presentation, Michelle Vorbach, the judicial committee.
Good evening, y'all. Thank you for having me. As mentioned, my name is Michelle Vorbach. I started the J at the end of June, actually. So I'm pretty new to Cornell as well as New York. So it's been really nice to get in front of different constituencies, especially from a shared governance perspective because of your role in helping write the code and draft it and really kind of recognizing the role that you play in that. So I thought I would do kind of a little brief introduction on myself and the office and then really leave some time for questions and answers. So I really want to hear from y'all. Background, I have a background in law and student affairs. I'm originally from Michigan. I spent time as a criminal defense attorney up there. Then I went down south and got my master's in student affairs from the University of Mississippi. So it's kind of a nice mix of the legislative and the judicial legal side, but also the idea that conduct really should be a place where individuals learn and grow from their experiences, because for the majority of our cases, which tend to be undergraduate cases, it's a time for learning and experimenting and making decisions. So our office is located in Day Hall. It's in 120. We don't handle academic integrity issues, and we don't handle 6.4 issues, so gender-based misconduct, which Sarah will talk about a little bit tonight. But we work closely with that office, and I'm a deputy Title IX coordinator, so there's sometimes when our roles were overlapped, we'll do a case analysis to find out what office has the best jurisdiction. The code actually covers faculty, staff, and students, which is a little bit unique to Cornell. For faculty and staff, it has to occur outside of the workplace environment, so we don't get many cases for that. But we've had some in the past, which are kind of unique and quirky. The code really says that we're a campus with freedom with responsibility. And the way that our office interprets that is that adult decisions come with adult consequences. And so we will never say, you can't do anything. Do you want to spray paint the building because you're so passionate about some political stance? I'm glad that you have that level of passion. And that doesn't mean that we can't talk about ways that you will have to then repair the harm for the damage you caused, but which I know is a little bit of a different stance from kind of past administrations. We really want it to be an educational process. So we want individuals to understand the wrongness of the behavior, really understand why it occurred, because people don't really set up on a Friday night to break the code and then have to come to the JA on Monday. That's not the goal. But you know, a student who's underage drinking might say, well, that's where people in my friend group were going, and I haven't made friends yet, so it seemed like an easy thing for me to do and go underage drinking. Why we spend some time trying to understand why the behavior occurred is because that's how we prevent recidivism. And so for the student who's saying that I was going out drinking because I didn't have a friend group, that's the root of the issue. So one of the educational sanctions that we might do would be to encourage them to go to the orientation fair or talk to the Center for Campus and Community Engagement, because we want them to be a productive member of our campus and be in good standing compliance. A student who came into our office and was saying, hey, I was drinking on a Friday night because I have an eating disorder and I have a drinking problem and that's the only way I can control it, that would be a very different intervention technique. After that, we hope that the individual will complete their sanctions and then return to good standing in our community. We have a couple things that we've changed with our office. So, for example, we have an online reporting form, which anyone can use, including members outside of our Cornell community. One of the ways that I think is really important for our inactions, especially the constituencies that you represent as grad and professional students, is really the intersection, especially with TAs. We know that teaching assistants are on the ground with our students. And it's not that you guys are hearing behavior that is reportable all the time, but there's some patterns. And so if you also hear some things where it just doesn't seem right, or things seem a little bit, you know, students are acting a little bit different, maybe it's lack of sleep, they haven't slept in a couple weeks. We also want that to be reported to things like our alert team and some of those standards, so we make sure that we are intervening with students in appropriate ways and proactive ways. I really want to hear from you guys, so I'm going to kind of turn it over to questions and then any feedback that you want. I also know that I have a limited time and I want to be respectful of your time, so if there's any conversations that you want to have more in depth, please let me know or send me an email. We can set up a one-on-one meeting to make sure that I understand the constituency groups that y'all represent.
All right, so some questions.
So, Stu, where would you want us to talk about the abnormal behavior that we see in students? And the second part to that question is, for my department, chemistry and chemical biology, we're told that if we see any abnormal behavior to tell our boss, and that's usually the route that I take in the past. Does that information get relayed from my boss to you guys? I'm not sure because I'm not at that part of the process.
Yeah, I don't know if it gets related or not, right, because I don't know what information gets sent. But there's something called the alert team on campus, and this is run through the Dean of Students office. And so if you go to their webpage, there's an alert tab. And this is, Cornell's had it for a long time, a committee and similar structure, but this is when we really saw a lot of schools after Virginia Tech, was that there's information silos. And with Cornell being as administratively siloed as any institution I've seen, this is a great way for individuals from across campus to get together and just say, hey, you know, this report came from Red Life, this report also came from chemistry. Let's see if we can help the students. So definitely follow the protocols in your office, but just know that anyone can report through the alert process, and it shouldn't just be observations that you notice.
Okay, so just do both in
case. Yeah, I don't think that hurts.
As it's on our agenda, could you briefly talk about some changes you wanted to make to the transcript notation?
Sure. So transcript notations is a tactic used when individuals have been suspended or expelled from the university. Under New York State law, 129D, there's certain offenses that have to be notated on the transcript, which is something that the university has been doing as soon as the law has been passed and in compliance with that. One of the things that I noticed, and I think this was just kind of being a set of fresh eyes at the university, was that the code of conduct actually didn't provide for transcript notations. It was just kind of an office practice that aligns with the best practices in conduct. I haven't been in an institution where there's not a notation. The model code of conduct talks about notation. And this is only for when individuals are suspended or expelled. Last year, I think the number was 29 individuals who had their transcripts notated. So on the whole, it's a relatively small number of individuals impacted. But I had concerns about the fact that it wasn't codified. And so I went to the CJC, to the Codes and Judicial Committee, and asked if we could do a resolution, because I wanted to make sure that the practice that had been in place since as long as anyone could remember at the university and the best practices in the conduct field were codified. I know that there's been a really neat compromise that we've established. I think one of the fears as we've been talking to different constituencies is, one, the long-term impact that this might have on an individual. And a lot of this goes back to the perception that individuals were being suspended for alcohol and drug violation use, not distribution manufacturing. Because there's sort of this weird rumor with the JA's office that three strikes and you're out, right? That we have students call and say, this is my third JA referral, should I pack my bags now? There is a code in the provision in the code that says if there's three offenses within 1 year, suspension or expulsion should be the default unless probation is appropriate, and seems like the probation is appropriate. So really hearing that feedback, the Judicial Code Counselor, the CJC, the University Assembly Chairman, and I, we sat down. We said, you know, we kind of see that there's three buckets. One is alcohol, drug, and use, not manufacturing and distribution. On the low end of the spectrum. On the complete other end, in the third bucket, would be 129D offenses, so the ones that we would have to notate, and a kind of a plus. So things like deadly weapon use would be something we would want to make sure transcripts are notated. But there's sort of this in-between ground. And so the compromise that was kind of proposed was to allow university hearing boards to have the discretion whether or not to notate. Our office's point of view is that anytime a student is suspended or expelled, we will always ask for suspension and expulsion if it doesn't fall into the alcohol drug use. And that's from consistency. We don't want to have that discretion. And I understand that it can be seen as punitive, but I think it also has a pretty strong deterrent effect. And the offenses that we are notating for suspension or expulsion are pretty serious consequences. So that's kind of an overview that you're hoping for. Can I answer anything?
Can I tack onto that?
Yes.
Could you elaborate more on what is 129B and what are legal obligations for regarding transcript notations, and then that third bucket that's kind of up to our discretion when we're done?
So 129D covers things like sexual assault, harassment, domestic violence, and Cleary offenses, so arson, burglary, armed robbery, as incorporated. So those are ones that we have to notate. We don't have the discretion one way or the other. What the CJC and Nathan's part of this, and they're really trying to decide what the other plus categories are. So, for example, deadly weapon use, or more kind of, you know, hazy might be an example, something we'd want permanently notated. The other bucket is everything that falls in between. And so since we don't have the plus category fully notated yet, it's hard to say what's going to be in that in-between bucket. But for example, maybe if someone stole three bikes, right? You know, three separate offenses, they stole, that was their first offense. There was some alcohol or drug use as their second offense. And the third offense would be they punched someone right in the face. We would say maybe that's someone who we would want their notation of suspension or expulsion. One of the things that I think is really interesting to note is that when we think about Cornell and the values that we have as our community, those are encapsulated in our code of conduct. That's what we said as a community we agree to. And I really think that we look at the reputational risks for our university, and we look at reputational risks to our academic side. So we have a strong curriculum. We have 100, you know, 20 credit hours. You guys have a set number within your graduate programs, because that's how we preserve the integrity of the degree. Conduct verifications are also how we preserve the integrity of the university, because we want to be able to say, we graduate individuals of high caliber and character. So if you hire someone, they're going to be compliant. They're going to be sound academically and character-wise. And so that's really where the idea of transcript notations come from in the kind of code of conduct in a large historical sense.
Derek.
So could you say you have to report the cases of sexual assault and similar things? How about years and other resources where it is not disclosed? So how does it work between the two?
Yeah, so the university has confidential resources. So EARS isn't necessary. EARS is because it's a counseling setting, so they have privilege. And our victims advocate and our campus ministers. So if anybody reports anything in that setting, unless it rises to something that would be breaking disclosure, so let's say there's a strong intimate threat, that disclosure could be broken, or if there's, for example, a rape of a minor, that would have to be reported, or, you know, behaviors like that. But those are confidential resources that we want our students to use. But we also want individuals to have a full scope of the sources and resources available to them. So please continue to refer your students to those sources, but if you're also willing to kind of tuck in Title IX and the JA's office, that would be really helpful to keep a safe community.
Yeah.
So you said your office doesn't really cover academic issues, so exemptions or expulsions resulting from academic dishonesty and misconduct would not be covered under this kind of segmentation stuff?
Correct, and that's one of the reasons that we're still working on a draft is because there's a lot of constituencies impacted besides those completely represented on the CJC. And so one of the things that we're really going to move in the next stage of looking at resolution is to talk about the academic boards and whether or not they would follow the same policies that are proposed in the code, or if they would still have the jurisdictional freedom to decide the length and tenure of what gets academically notated.
Yeah, much less.
So just to clarify, is when you say transcript notation, is it just going to say suspension or expulsion, and or will it like be a reason for the suspension or expulsion?
So 129 requires an explanation of the offense. So it would say suspended for sexual harassment. The code would just say, if it was a suspension based on that, would say suspended for disciplinary reasons or for conduct charges. One of the things that it is really important for us to consider with the 129D is that the law allows for a revocation of the second part of that notation. So after a year, that second part could be dropped. And that's something that, you know, we're really starting to look at. But I think that's a question for Sarah as well, that she'd be able to elaborate a little more fully.
All right, so if people want to get in touch with you, the address is your...
MRH263.
And Lucia and I are both the GTSA representatives on the... GTSA. Oh, and Matt Pataglia. So actually, you and Matt Pataglia are... and so you can get in contact with us to be more in tune with those conversations. Thank you so much.
Perfect. Thanks, guys. Have a good night.
So next on our list is breakout sessions. So
yeah, as per usual, can we have biological sciences, humanities, social sciences, physical sciences up in the back, and if you are a professional student or please share come see me. Yeah.
Thank you. You, whatever's more convenient for you. I will also entertain a motion to suspend reading the resolution in its entirety. And just let move. You give us a summary. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any dissent? Seeing none, that's what we're going to do.
Cool.
Okay. Take it away.
Cool. So, short resolution to support a petition that's been going around. Show of hands, have people seen the petition to make Cornell Sanctuary campus? Okay, so I don't have to read before asking the petition out loud. Yeah, so four. First one is asking the university for an explicit denouncement of act of discrimination against marginalized communities, and then just another explicit affirmation of the values of diversity and inclusion at Cornell. Second is a reaffirmation of commitment to DACA program. Third is commitment to resist any kind of action by ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement on Cornell's campus. The mayor of Ithaca, they're already declared Ithaca, will do this as a city. So this is something that Ithaca said it will do. So this is like Cornell's part of it. That's a layer here that's happening. And then last, short, we ask that you provide legal and counseling services, information, and updates for students who may be directly affected by local spending policy changes. So that's what the petition is asking for. There have been petitions like this that dozens of business schools across the U.S. to where I thought have all this. There have been college presidents calling on affirmation of DACA. So this resolution kind of affirms that we support this petition, we support everything the petition says, and we would like to see the university make a statement about marginalized communities on campus that attends to the specificity of those communities. So that's what's there.
Okay, so what I'd like to do is try out the system that Nate suggested, I think, at the last meeting, one of the standing rules. So we're going to move into a Q&A section. And so just please, this is a question specifically for Jesse, and I guess the sponsors of the resolution. Please refrain from statements, and then we'll move to a speaker list after that. So we'll start with Richard on Q&A.
So the mayor of Ithaca has said that Ithaca will be a sanctuary city, but I could apply to, so Cornell's campus spans multiple jurisdictions, so we go to the town of Ithaca, city of Ithaca, is there anything, I didn't have time to read this in depth, is there anything in there about asking the other mayors or other leaders of those municipalities to declare their area sanctuary cities, or just saying that, you know, Cornell will make itself a sanctuary regardless of their city?
So the petition is specifically only aimed at Cornell University, not the other communities on whose land Cornell occupies.
Yeah.
As a follow-up to that, I don't know what the legality associated with resisting ICE is. Is it upwards, I think?
Yeah, so this is that's actually a really good question. This is something that's really been undecidable for a lot of the folks that are doing this around the country. So there are folks who are, so thinking about faculty who are giving their kind of expert hand on this. I've read folks who are very much saying this is something that universities can do to show their support to students. I've heard other faculty say that, you know, this is a good show of solidarity with students and faculty and staff and families. But if push came to shove and Southern Programs of Immigration came with a legal reason to get information about students, this sanctuary statement might not be able to hold up. So we don't know for sure, but there's suspicion that it might not. There's suspicion that it might. There are complications about different kinds of universities. So there's complications here about how this would work in practice. And I have statements about that, but that's not Q&A topic.
I can just speak more to that point slightly. Nobody who hasn't sworn an oath of office has to cooperate with ICE agents, and this is what we're really talking about. So if ICE agents come up to you and say, hey, can you tell me about so-and-so? You can just say, who? If they have a subpoena and somebody doesn't turn over information, then they could be held in contempt of court and potentially fined or imprisoned. If ICE manages to get a warrant for, it's complicated. As an institution, it could be very difficult if push came to shove. make it clear that you want them adopted jointly or separately, which is to say that currently I know Cornell has already issued a statement on DACA, and that it's actually going to continue to honor DACA-related policies, even if the DACA program is repealed. So I think it will only help clarify our position if we say that we want these positions endorsed if they haven't been already. We want them separately implemented.
Yeah, I'm also in support of this, but I think that there needs to be this doesn't need to go into the resolution, but I think there needs to be a commitment from the GPSA to see this through if we're going to amend our support to this, and we need to be involved with the administration in terms of helping them make this, just making it clear to them that we want this to happen and having these conversations with them. So I think that I'm fine for this, but I think it cannot end here for us.
Does anyone else like to speak? Alex?
Yeah, I also think it's a good idea just in terms of putting it on the record explicitly. That's the sense of the body that this is what we are in favor of, and that no matter where this decision goes from there, we'll still have that asset.
Ian?
This is more of a question to the audience. Does anyone know if the other assemblies are looking at
Gina would know.
Actually, there's conversation about creating a joint resolution with all of the assemblies to have it carried that much more weight. So there are the petition was fairly new, and this is the first assembly to meet after the petition has been made available, but the other assemblies are aware of taking it up as well.
Sorry, this breaks the rules slightly, but can I ask, would you know what the status is of that joint resolution at the other bodies?
Under consideration right now. I just reached out to the petition sponsors to reach out to the assembly's leadership to see about putting that together.
Okay. Thank you, Gina.
Mm-hmm. I'll just say when I was talking to folks who were working on the petition, I didn't know that wasn't the same motion at the time. So.
Okay.
Richard?
Sort of provide the perspective from before on that. When the divestment issue came up and the resolutions were passed by all the four assemblies, this was years ago, it wasn't like the same text in each resolution that carried the weight, it was the message that carried the weight. So if we pass this resolution, it doesn't necessarily mean that, like, it doesn't mean that we are out of the joint resolution later, it just means that, like, it's important that all four assemblies pass the support of the petition, I think, not necessarily that all four assemblies pass the exact same worded resolution in each one. So I would necessarily say that that's a reason for us to not pass this resolution.
All right, unless anyone else, yeah, Jesse.
Can I ask Nathaniel to elaborate a little bit on how you heard what you were suggesting before?
Yes. Yeah, so essentially that we ask that all of the asks in the petition be implemented, and even if some of them can't be or some of them already have been, that we want the other ones implemented. So that we're not calling for one piece of action that is either accepted or rejected as a whole.
Brian.
Thanks. I also in support of this. I'm caught on the discriminatory and hateful actions piece, and I'm caught on it because I'm wondering if there's more that GPSA can do in terms of, so we have resources, Club Finance Council, for example. Can you incorporate something that promotes more events and activities for students that speak against these actions? Is there more that could be done related to the TA educational trainings that go into the first couple of weeks of class that we as graduate students could do to promote students? Is there more that could be done?
Can I comment on that? I'm part of the TA training program, so we should talk afterwards and speak with that together.
Sweet.
Yes.
Point of information. That's what you want to
point
do.
Of information.
Yeah.
Following point of information, I know the FT is also looking into providing more funding for organizations that meet the DPCI requirements, and these are all things that fall into the DPCI requirements. So we are trying to encourage more organizations to vocally have events that relate to those things.
Point of parliamentary procedure, when you make a point of information, you say point of information, then you wait for the chair to recognize you and then you speak. Otherwise, point of information, here's my opinion. Yeah, that's not how that works.
Well, there's a bit of a procedure.
Thanks.
I'm going to motion to amend the resolution
non-voting membership feels about that. We can get that in a minute and get that So my motion is that we table this until
here, Apple's not here, right?
Oh, okay.
I'm here, yeah.
Yeah.
So everyone, I withdraw my motion, I'll work on it right now.
Okay,
can we take
hold on, we're gonna get to Richard and then you can issue. Yes.
Well,
one name for
Andrew was let out of speech was ready, because then that would be perfect timing for us to
the speaker is not ready. Manisha, do you have something?
I'd say that if we want to table that, I'm only comfortable that with that if we at least take a straw poll of the entire assembly so that it's shown on the record how we feel about it, even if we don't have an official vote of the voting members today.
Is that a motion or is that just a...
I don't know if we're motioning to table it, so I only feel that way.
We're not motioning to table it, right?
Yeah.
I actually, technically, what's the motion made?
I would do it. You're drawn.
Okay.
Alex, you're next.
A motion to take the straw poll as we just discussed.
Second?
Okay, there's a second. Is there any dissent to taking the straw poll? Seeing none, we're going to conduct a straw poll. This is all members. This is all members. Ex officio, field rep, voting members. If you are in favor of the resolution, I guess let's say with the proposed amendment language, whatever nebulous thing, but the spirit of that is. Raise your hand or placard or whatever. All right, that looks good. And hands down. And if you are opposed to this resolution, raise your hand. And
if you are abstaining.
If you are abstaining, yes. If you are abstaining from the resolution and for whatever reason, raise your placard or slash hand. We have a couple. Okay, so that is the straw. We're going back to the speaker's list. Is there anyone else who'd like to talk on the speaker's list while we're making changes? Yeah. Sorry. off by a little bit.
I just wanted to underline Manisha's point because while we're waiting on them, I just want to underline that this is definitely something that is not a be all end all, but a very real issue for a lot of students and faculty and staff and on the campus. So there will be follow up work to be done, and we'll look forward to seeing what next semester brings us to that follow up work. So I just want to underline that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
specifically affect historically marginalized communities rather than through generalized comments about students of all identities.
Amendment to the amendment on line 34. Right now, you've got formally declared itself a sanctuary campus. The subject of the sentence is the Cornell administration.
Oh,
it's not a sanctuary
correct,
campus.
Thank you.
To declare Cornell. Thank you. That's an amendment to the amendment.
It is taken from.
In the back. Wait, hold on. You formally made a motion to amend. We need a second.
Second.
Oh, wait, do you have just approval? Second. Is there. Okay, so now we're moving to.
Yeah, we now enter discussion on the amendment, which you already had.
Further discussion on the amendment? Yeah.
Question, call a question on the amendment.
Second, is there any dissent to calling a question on the amendment? Seeing none, now we're going to vote on this amendment. If you're in favor of Nate's amendment, raise the black vote. Voting members.
1, 2, 3.
Hold on. I count 11. You can do. You don't. Okay. 11.
Who left?
You don't have 4 questions tonight?
Yeah, you the chair can't vote. And you can't vote on your own amendment? Why not? Oh, that's right, you're not voting. I keep getting confused. Okay, so that's 11. That's a majority, right?
Not.
The amendment.
Yes, it's a majority.
Yep, it's a majority.
Point of inquiry, how many members do we need for quorum?
You need
10.
10. Yeah,
okay.
So we're
and we have 10.
Yeah, we have 10. And so now we're back into the speakers list on the resolution as a whole. So up in the back.
Did you get this final version that you guys have over email to distribute to our fields today?
Yeah. Well, yeah, we'll send it on.
Motion to call a question.
Second.
Is there any dissent to calling the question? Seeing none, we will now vote on the resolution. Resolution 7.
In support of
making Cornell a sanctuary campus, all those in favor of Resolution 7, raise your placards.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Yep. Okay. Any opposed?
You shouldn't, because you're only opposed here.
Good. And everyone else. So, close. As resolution passes, we'll work at getting that, we'll get over to getting that up on that board quickly. All right, it's Sarah here.
She's here at 6:45.
Right, we're motion to move open forum ahead of the presentation. Is there a second to that motion? Second. Is there any sense to moving open forum? Seeing none, we will move into open forum. Okay, Nate.
So there's no way I'm going to get that email and resolution put that resolution put the scanning rules out before the end of the semester. Sorry, I will send you guys an email right now, the link to a cheat sheet. And also, Cornell Law School is doing this cool thing where you give toys or money to small children, or to us, and we give them to small children. The program, maybe, if we feel like it. The program is called the Cornell Elves. I don't know why they don't just call it Cornell. Yeah, if you want to give money to it, you can talk to me or Julia Benser or Jay Wexler. But basically, you can either sponsor an entire child, you can buy a thing, or you can donate money.
All right.
Sponsor that, please send it to me. I'll put it on the Facebook page.
All right. Anyone else for open forum? All right.
Just to encourage people, if they weren't haven't already, to seek out this petition that we just voted to endorse, especially if you're one of the 12 people who just voted that we as a body should endorse it. It's a little weird if your name personally isn't on there.
voting membership of the assembly, which is the group of people who cares enough to get in this room, feels like this is time sensitive, then we can vote to add it to the agenda, and that is what we did. I would endorse really heartily everything Nisha said, and I would add also that there is just like out of necessity of getting people in a room together, we can't publish our agenda, you know, 3 weeks out and give lots and lots of time to talk about it. The last thing I would say, this was an email that I was going to send out last night, but then didn't, is that I want to make sure all the field reps know that even though you guys can't vote on resolutions, you have equal speaking rights to voting members. So you just raise your hand, you run the speaker list. It's not like we deal with it, like not like we take the voting members first and then the field reps. Field reps just get to speak just the same as anybody else.
And make motions.
And make motions, not voting.
Brian, point of information, I haven't seen the petition yet, but does Cornell have a formal process of dealing with petitions like that, or is there a formal way of providing resources for students to raise petitions? Now, my question is mainly as with the comments earlier that alumni are already on the petition, that Todd could have simply added all of us to the petition. So my question is, of the petition itself, and if Cornell has the infrastructure for providing for a petition.
Since Nate is enthusiastic to answer that question,
the assembly can move to hold a referendum, if that's kind of what you're getting at. What we did just now is sponsor the petition, endorse the petition. What we're saying is the GPSA as an institution is behind this petition. It would be great if those of you who want to sign it as members would also like to sign it for individual support. And then the other thing that we could do as an assembly is hold a referendum on the issue, which would be our own petition, essentially, within ourselves.
Ian?
Just to add to that, I think part of the reason we have to think like what we just did is because that a resolution enters the formal process by which we communicate to the president, and the president has to respond. So there was not necessarily a formal process just for the petition, but now that we've endorsed it,
My comment isn't about the substance of this petition, it's about petitions generally.
I don't think we're not a general question.
Sure.
But if an assembly decides to endorse the petition, then that is one way of beginning a formal process that they would do.
Bouncing off of that, the formalized process would be essentially asking the assembly to host a referendum on it. That would be the formal version.
All right, is there anything else for open forum? Otherwise, we're going to suggest Sarah here to move back to the presentation. All right.
Good evening. My name is Sarah Apple. I'm the university's Title IX coordinator. I've been here for the past several years as the lead investigator for issues around sexual assault, dating violence, domestic violence, and stalking, and recently moved into the role of Title IX coordinator, trying to hit on what I think you guys will be most interested in. I run through a few different the changes in the policy and procedures, and I'll notice, and I'll try to make sure I leave time for questions as well. So I always like to start off any presentation hitting on two things. First, the mission statement, and then the second is what is Title IX. Because those two things can easily be confused, and sometimes we use one as a catch-all for another. So this is Cornell University's mission statement around sexual and gender-based violence and discrimination at the university, and it's very straightforward. It's that we do not tolerate gender-based harassment, sexual assault, domestic and dating violence, stalking, sexual exploitation, or other forms of sexual misconduct committed by or against students, staff, or faculty. Title IX, on the other hand, is a federal law. It's a very brief federal law with a very simple statement. It's come to mean many different things over time. It simply says that as an institution that wants to continue to receive federal funding, we will not discriminate on the basis of sex. People think of Title IX in many different ways. 20 years ago, people may have immediately associated it with athletics. 40 years ago, it was an incredibly important part of the movement many different forms of sexual violence that had a variety of names over time that we found might be a little confusing to students or really anyone who read it, and moved them into sexual assault, a term that's fairly well understood, and taken that term to define it broadly as contact or penetration that is without affirmative consent. The other area that I wanted to point out with a little bit more specificity for this particular group is some changes in the language to how we define sexual and gender-based harassment. It's not exactly a change in substance. This type of conduct was always prohibited at Cornell, but we thought it was important to find ways to call out to students and to better define particularly gender-based harassment, so students understood that this policy wasn't simply about what you might think of as traditional sexual harassment, somebody, you know, smacking somebody else behind next to a photocopy machine in an HR video made in the 80s. This has always been more than that as a policy, and we wanted to make sure that the common reader said, oh, this is really about unwanted sexual advances, requests for sexual favors. It's about verbal, nonverbal conduct, and it's also about gender-based harassment, and to make it as clear as possible to anyone reading our policy that it applies equally to all students without respect for gender, sex, gender identity, sexual orientation, and gender expression. So we did that by adding in gender-based harassment and specific language around that. I have the full definition in front of you. I won't read the whole thing, and I promise I did not put up slides for every single type of misconduct that would take all night. But I wanted to highlight this. The other thing that we did around sexual harassment is to take what it is that makes a hostile environment. So that is to say, one or two bad jokes may or may not be the type of sexual harassment that would be a violation of our procedures, but there's still conduct that is unwanted and should be stopped. When we look at our policy, what we're looking at here is when has it gotten to the point where there should be a disciplinary action or a university's formal disciplinary intervention. It's an important distinction within our policies and procedures. Anywhere in these red boxes of conduct that you're seeing in your educational environment, we want students and we want you to go out and tell your colleagues, your peers, if you're seeing that type of conduct, we want you to feel empowered to go tell your faculty member, tell the DGS in your department, or come tell me, whoever you're comfortable with talking to, tell the dean of students in your professional school, so that the school can help step in. Because when we talk about hostile environment at the bottom, that's when we're going to take a disciplinary action. That's when it becomes sufficiently severe, persistent, or pervasive. We don't want to hear that the educational environment where there's unwanted So the understanding that these initial measures are the primary first mission of our office, because this is how we can have students accessing their education. A little bit about what doesn't happen when a report comes in, and this was true before, this isn't new to my office and Dan, but what doesn't happen if I receive a report is I don't call the police. Students have the right to make the decision on whether they want to work with the police, the university, both, or neither. I don't take that choice away from you. I don't contact parents, coaches, advisors, academics, advising deans, faculty members, none of those. That's your choice. If you want us in talking to the community, we're here to be part of that. The next and most important thing maybe that doesn't happen is that disciplinary process that I was mentioning. So I think one of the things that has come up in regular questioning, particularly when we talk to graduate students who want to be reporting sexual harassment that involves staff and faculty, they say, well, I don't want the other person to know. I'm worried about retaliation. I'm not sure I'm ready. I just want to know about my options. So one of the things that we can say here is that a formal complaint or giving notice to the other person involved is not what happens immediately upon reporting something. Our job is to make sure that we're working with the impacted student, who we call the complainant or the victim, about what's happened to them and what they need out of the process and how they're going to have access to their education. We strongly support that decision making in all circumstances, whether the accused person is a student, staff, or faculty member. I will say that there's the caveat that when we are concerned that a safety concern for the community cannot be mitigated, or there cannot be, or we just feel like we can't have a safe or non-discriminatory educational environment, we may need to go forward with a complaint when the student would want to, but we'll be having a conversation with you about why we're doing that. So for example, we may have more information about the person you're accusing, because we've been able to track that over time to see if there's a pattern of conduct, whereas you may have had one negative experience, I may know about three or four with the same person. So trying to take all of those into account are a big part of our role, but it's something that would happen in conversation with the student. So this next part, one of the other questions that was asked to me, so that was a basic overview of what our office does. The second question that was asked was a little bit about what the procedures are. This is far too small of a slide. I wasn't thinking when I did it, so I'll try to run through it with you. I'm sorry, bad presentation skills. The first is prohibited conduct against the student. You've seen the list of what that prohibited conduct was, and I'm going to run through quickly how those procedures look. The reports against staff and reports against faculty, policy 6.4 is not only a sexual misconduct policy, it is our discrimination policy for all employees of the university. So it's under these same procedures that claims of bias or discrimination, whether it's based on gender or race or national origin, are handled. One change, and there are some questions about changes, the one change that happened this year is that the procedures for students were spun out of policy 6.4 to make it easier to read and follow what happens to a student. The
question and then a slightly more involved question. So the quick question is, am I correct reading from your slides that Cornell's policies are an affirmative consent policy?
Correct.
Okay.
Cornell has an affirmative consent policy that's been about 2 years with the definition that says affirmative consent. You've been about 10 years with a definition that actually is affirmative consent. We changed the language to meet the law, but Cornell's long had that policy.
Okay, and then my bigger question is, can you tell me, is there any enforcement provision in effect for the faculty handbook policy on avoiding all romantic and sexual student relationships? And related to that, is there a reason that you can talk to us about now why policy 6.4 appendix C wasn't changed in the 6.4 revisions? Because my understanding is that that runs afoul of some provisions in the Dear Colleague letter, et cetera.
Yeah, so we'll start with the romantic relationship policy. The deans of the colleges handle that. So for example, the report, sometimes those reports may come to my office first. It's a natural place for them to end up, but they also may go to a DGS or a leader of the department. It is, the faculty handbook has many different areas of misconduct and other things in it where the dean is the primary authority for faculty members. So the dean may reach out to a special investigator in my office or workforce policy and labor relations to ask that the investigation be done there, but they are not required to. They can take is not one that we're going to use the term manager for. There are some people in the university and world who are those. They generally is a New York State law that has to do with the elderly and juveniles. So we have, separate from that, we have what we call the duty to consult at Cornell. It is a written into policy 6.4 that any member of the staff and faculty who receive information that, if true, might be a violation of policy 6.4, have an obligation to consult with the Title IX coordinator. And that's really filling out that form or calling me. So for
where do we have to stop the
faculty? So what we talk about is when students are doing an employment role, it has been the stance of the university that if you're at work, so this includes, so for example, we have dining managers. A dining manager who is at work and receives a complaint from another student that they were sexually harassed by an employee in dining. That person is at work, they're working as a dining manager in that moment. They're going to share that information through their duty to consult. That person who was harassed may also be their friend. They could be out drinking in a totally other situation and be saying, oh my God, did you hear about this person? Do you know how they treated me? They're not at work right then. So there is a different distinction that we have with our full-time staff and faculty who are not students. We take off our hat of working far less frequently. You could share things with me in most settings and it would be part of the duty to consult as an administrator at the university. You could go grab Jana right now, or you could grab her if she's having coffee at 7 in the morning at Guinea. She's probably going to have a duty to consult no matter where you grab her. Student, if we have a similar rule, our residential advisors are trained separately on this. Their obligations are not entirely through policy 6.4. There are two separate federal and state laws that have nothing to do with Title IX, and also in many ways have nothing to do with sexual assault. They have to report things like alcohol violations. So there are other things that impact them, but it is while you're at work. So we're trying, and I've done a lot this semester, but I know there's more to do to have that message out there. You are not at work a lot of the time, but you are at work sometimes, and students will come in to a person who is actually primarily a student here, but also their TA, and say, I need additional time on this test because I was sexually assaulted this weekend and spent all Saturday at the hospital, and now I'm running behind. We know my opposition, they came to you in your role as a staff member, not as a student or a friend. They came to you because they thought of you as in that role, and we expect you to usually, hopefully, just go to the faculty member who knows how to come to me as well. I know it's been integrated, some departments have long integrated it in their training, some are sort of catching up.
Can we move to email leaders after?
Yeah, right.
Okay. So if you'd like to ask more questions to Sarah, you can reach her at titleix@cornell.edu. We could exhaust her time. I will not entertain any more motions to send me.
Motion to adjourn.
There, I will need a motion to adjourn. Is there a second to adjourn?
Second.
Okay. Is there any dissent to adjourn in the meeting? Seeing none, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.